This is the Pitch Vision Academy show number 85. This is the Pitch Vision Academy cricket show. You can find us at pitchvision.com and email us on mycricketcoach@pitchvision.com. My name's David Hinchliffe in the UK.
And I'm Kevin Sappas from Australia. Coming up in the show, David talks declarations again, and we answer your questions for this week. David, topic of declarations comes up again and again. What is it this time?
Well, it's an interesting one this week. I know I talk a lot about declarations on this show, probably more than I should, but it's one of those things that interests me more than it probably should. It's so much so that I had a little look at things this week in a quiet 5 minutes, and I came up with some interesting information. So let's talk about the game, and I will present you with this information once I've told you what happened in the game. So, yeah. As you know, we play our 100 over afternoon one day matches where declarations are possible, and I won the toss again, and I Perfect. Chose to bat on a pretty traditional English club wicket in sort of mid season. We got off to a good start, but unfortunately, when one of our openers fell, the other opener didn't quite know what to do. He's a attacking batsman. He likes to attack, and he used to play limited over style cricket. You know, the type of cricket where you can't have a draw. So he's used to batting quite aggressively, even from the off. And it's the first time he's opened for us because our normal opener decided he wanted to bat a little bit down the order because he'd been a bit out of form. So this guy went in, and I just expected him to play his normal game, which is an aggressive form of cricket, and he's opened before, so I didn't feel I needed to talk to him. But he decided that he was going to go for the anchor role. And bat through the innings. Unfortunately, it didn't quite go the way that he wanted it to go, and he batted very, very slowly, and that slowed our run rate down significantly. We started reasonably well. Off the first 10 overs, we had 31, which isn't too bad, you know, especially with a new ball. But then after 30 overs, we were only on 69.
Oh, wow.
So at one point, we got one run in about 6 overs. So he was caught between sort of two stools, and he didn't really know what to do and ended up sort of blocking out a bit too much. But he did a good job for us because he got to 40-odd, and then he was out. And although it took him a long time, he was out. He was in for 105 minutes.
Oh, wow.
To score his 41. So, but, he set up a base for us. And I was hoping for 200 at the 30-over mark, you know, because I knew we had some big hitters to come in, and indeed the big hitters did come in. The next three batsmen all gave it some welly, and we went from 30 overs 69, 40 overs 141, 50 nice. Overs 237. So
nice.
The last 20 overs we really gave it some fearful biff. I didn't declare. After last week saying, I should be more aggressive with our declarations.
Yeah.
As you know, last week we got 260. This week we got 237. And this week I decided that probably wasn't going to declare until I got to 200. And then we got to 200 in the 48th over. I thought to myself, well, is there any point in declaring with two overs to go? I'll just leave it run, and we'll grind them into the dirt a little bit. So, yet again, I didn't declare, and we finished on 237.
Yeah.
Which is a good total, and again, you know, we thought, well, we can bowl them out in 50 overs, but unfortunately, yet again, we were foiled by a young batsman who batted through a very, very good innings, 68. He scored 68 in 50 overs. Which you might think, well, that's very slow, but you know, he did exactly what was required. They decided to not go for it right from the start, and he batted through the innings. You know, he set his stall out to bat through the innings, only hit the bad ball, defend anything straight, and that's exactly what he did.
Yeah.
So we had him 170 for six at the end, which was a little bit disappointing. We tried seven bowlers. So
yeah.
It wasn't like we didn't try all our bowling options. After the game, somebody did say to me that perhaps I overbowled the leg spinner because I gave him his full contingent of 15 overs. And the other bowlers, you know, they got, you know, a handful of overs, you know, 9, 7, 6. One got 2 overs, one got 3 overs, one got 8 overs. So you could say that maybe I overbowled the leg spinner when it was not likely that he was going to bowl anybody out because he didn't get any wickets. You could argue that. But, you know, I changed the bowling and I don't think I would have changed anything looking back. Maybe, you know, maybe try the bowlers in a different order or something. But what can you do? There's only so much you can do. I think really the game was lost, or the draw was inevitable, was when we scored over 200. Because I don't think they were ever going to go for it. And the reason I think that, I thought about this and I thought, now, what would be, whenever we play these games, we always say, you know, 200 is a good score to get in your 50 overs. We always say that as a general rule. So I thought to myself, well, does that pan out in the actual games? So the scorebook that we've got here, we've been using for 2 years. So this is the third year of use. So we've got 2.5 seasons worth of matches in this. So I thought I'll go back over all the games, find all the games where we batted first.
Yeah.
It didn't take very long. I just went through the scores. Find all the games where we batted first, look at the results, and look at the scores. Now, what do you think the average score is of the opposition batting second after we batted first? What would you say an average score? Bear in mind that the rule of thumb around here is 200 in 50 overs. What would you say an average score batting second is?
I would say about 150 to 180, David.
Well, bear in mind that this is all games. So this is some games where if we were bowled out for 100, then all they needed was 101 to knock them off. But this is all games, all results, win, lose or draw. The average score batting second against us is 118.
118, wow.
Yeah.
Now, that's pretty alarming.
Now, if you take out if you look at it in a little bit more detail, in the 21 games that I looked at, only once has the opposition ever scored more than 200. And it was 201, and that was a draw. Yeah. And only 5 times have they scored over 150 against us.
Wow.
So when you look at it like that, when you look at the raw statistics like that, you kind of think to yourself, well, hang on a minute. Am I over-egging the pudding a bit, thinking 200 is a big score? Because from the looks of those figures, 170 is a big score.
Yeah.
Against the type of players that we're playing against. Obviously, 170 is a big score. Now, the thing is, if you declare on 170, so say I declared at the end of the 43rd over on 173 in this game, then you've taken the draw completely out of the equation. You have to be pretty brave to do that, don't you?
Yeah.
What you've said is, we've given ourselves 7 extra overs to bowl you out. You've got 7 extra overs to get what any team should be able to get, 173, because 200 is a good score.
Yeah.
Now, in this particular case, they would have won that game. If you don't take into account the sort of the pressure of the situation of having to chase it down.
Yeah.
But if I declared after 46 overs, or let's say 45 overs on 183, now I think that would have been quite an interesting game. Because they got 170 and 50.
Yeah.
So, well, you could argue that they weren't really going for it. So if they'd have gone for it a bit more, maybe they'd have scored more runs, but maybe they'd have lost more wickets. As it was, they lost 6.
Yeah.
So could we say if they were playing more attacking strokes, and some players came in and they literally were blocking everything. So, you know, if somebody came in and thought to himself, well, I've got to win the game, I've got to play a few shots here. Because 100 and, let's say, 100 and, 183. So someone still has to score the runs. And that kid who batted through for 68, he would have felt the pressure to get on with it, wouldn't he?
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, that changes the game. So I'm leaning now heavily towards saying, let's take the draw out of the possibilities of the game. We're either going to win this game or we're going to lose this game.
As an opposition as well, David, each team would know their sort of benchmark, what they can or cannot achieve. So if you're saying the kind of opposition you're facing as a second over target of anything more than 150, I think every team, as soon as you get over that 180 mark, they would sort of go into that negative mindset to block it out. So if you give them more overs, then they just start worrying about lasting the extra overs. But interesting to know, David, the teams that are batting second or the opposition you play, do they get access to all the statistics online? Because I know that we get access to all our teams and competition statistics. Do they get access to that as well? Because I know when we go into games, we sort of look at their teams, our opposition's figures, their average scores, their top batsmen. Do you get access to all those statistics?
Actually, this season is the first season where we've done that. The league has required us now to put everything online just this season.
Yep.
So, and that has been handy. I have been looking at opposition, you know, how many runs the opposition have been scoring this season and things like that. So, you know, for example, next week's game, I know that the opposition have never scored more than 140 this season, either batting first or second. So now I can say to myself, if we get to 170 or 180, we can declare.
There's a good chance you can. Yeah, exactly. Yep.
We can declare. And if you get to 180 in 45 overs, you're giving yourself 55 overs to bowl out a team who you know cannot score 180. Or they certainly haven't this season so far. But you play cricket where declarations are possible, don't you? What kind of a score would make you nervous, more nervous for a declaration, and as a bowler make you think, right, I've got to really pull my finger out here, because if we don't bowl them out, we're going to have to are we going to lose? You know, there's no, you know, a sporting declaration, as they call it. What what sort of figures would you look at? So if you were setting a team a target of 150, you'd be saying to yourself, okay, that's, you know, we could probably win here. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. But there's been a couple of instances last year where there was three quarters of the day's play left and our captain declared it about 110 for them to win.
Okay.
And, you know, you just know that if the team comes out with all guns blazing and everything just seems to click, they can get those runs easily. But you also know that if they have a collapse in the middle order or even in the top order, then we can walk away with the game. So that's when it sort of comes down to who can hold their nerves better.
Oh, interesting. So your captain will be prepared to make quite a aggressive declaration in order to try and win the game.
Yeah, he did. He did that a lot of times last season. There's a lot of players in our team that try and talk him out of it, which are mainly the batsmen for some reason. But
yeah, batsmen never want to declare.
Yeah.
If batsmen ran the game, they'd only bat and there'd be no fielding or bowling.
But our captain was always, he saw every game as an opportunity to get full points, which is coming away with second innings points. And he thought that if we come away with first inning points, that's all right, but we still haven't done enough to come away with maximum points, especially with teams that have actually lost all their points to other teams in a similar position to us. Mm. So if we've seen teams that have given away second innings points to the first, second, and third teams, then we go into that game thinking, all right, we need to make an aggressive declaration early in the game here so we can try and get those full points.
Well, that's interesting, because I think probably that's not a common thing in this country to make an aggressive declaration like that. I think that's probably quite uncommon. And maybe part of the reason is that you get batting points. So if you want maximum batting points, you've got to score 200.
Yeah.
So in that way, if you declare on 179, for example, which you might think is a winning total, 179, they're never going to get that. We know that they've never scored more than 120 this season. They're a very poor batting side. We've got a very strong bowling side. We know we can bowl them out for less than 179 easily. Then you lose two batting points. which is not really very fun. I mean, it's only 2 points, and they, you know, there's a lot of points to play within. I mean, it's not like you where you get 4 points for winning the second innings. Yeah. You know, you'll get in a, if you win, if you have a maximum win, I think it's 28 points. So to lose 2 points is, you know, you don't want to do that. You want to, ideally, you want to score 200 and then bowl them out. It's a bit of a tricky one. It's a bit of a tricky one when it comes to declarations in this country, because gone are the days. I mean, a few years ago, well, I'm talking maybe 20 years ago, before really league cricket was really going strong, we didn't have any restriction on the overs. It was purely time games.
Yeah.
So it was completely up to the captain of the team batting first to put in a declaration. Yeah. And if he didn't put in a decent declaration, then that was the game over. Now at least you have to bowl 50 overs each. You know, you can't just keep batting. But
yeah,
I still think we're moving more towards playing limited over cricket, which would be a shame, because there's something beautiful about saving a game, even if you're miles behind, but you don't lose.
Yeah,
that does give your team something that you can say, well, all right, we were still 75 runs behind them at the end, but we didn't lose.
It's good points right there, David. But we have a couple of questions here, so we should get straight into it.
Sure.
Welcome to the question section for this week. David, our first question is from Adam, and he's been having a bad season so far. He says, both team-wise and personally, I've had a bad season. We played 6 and lost 6 as a team, and my scores in 4 innings have been 7, 8, 0, and 4, but I'm learning a lot. He says, our last game was played on a surprisingly bouncy wicket with balls coming past chest height. I was so used to coming forward due to the nature of our pitches that I've never really needed to go on the back foot. Needless to say, I found it very difficult. This highlighted the importance of my footwork as opposed to stepping forward to playing most shots. I found my batting stance so comfortable, I find it hard to move from it. And he says he knows that sounds silly, but he says, I'm sure I know where the ball is going, but I think it is too late to react. David, he asks, would trigger movements help with this? He says, I've heard people speak of taking a tiny step forward with one's back foot before the ball is bowled to encourage foot movement. If you need to go forward by watching where the ball is released, something else he thinks would help him, above the head down to the high five position, for example, you could then step further forward than you otherwise could. Or if you needed to go back, then it is easier to move the back foot, as the movement has transferred most of one's weight onto the front foot. Is that a good idea, or is there anything else that may help? David, we don't see this problem as much in Australia, but I saw it a lot in India, and when I asked one of the kids, he said he was trying to emulate Ricky Ponting, because Ricky Ponting does have that sort of forward movement, and then he gets back really smoothly. But what do you think would help Adam, David?
Well, I think there's a lot talked about trigger movements, and I think for a lot of levels, particularly the level Adam is playing, because I know Adam is a relative newcomer to cricket, something like a trigger movement is really asking for trouble, in my opinion. The idea of trigger movements is that if you're playing against really quick bowling, then you can get your feet moving by, you know, going back and across or something like that. So, you know, that's great for sort of the higher level players. But what tends to happen with the lesser players, especially those who are just sort of starting their game, is they focus so much on what type of trigger move they should have and the timing of the movement, when they should get it right, and do they go forward, do they go back, you know, what's going on. You know, they try and copy Michael Vaughan or Ricky Ponting or whoever is, Kevin Peterson, whoever's in vogue at the time, and they forget about just standing, watching the ball and hitting it, which is boring and doesn't sound very interesting. But that is what is more important. What tends to happen when you have a trigger move and you don't really know what you're doing is you get it wrong. You either mistime it or you end up closing yourself up. For example, the Michael Vaughan trigger move, where you start quite wide outside the leg stump, you move your back foot back and across, and then you move your front foot across to get back into a sideways on position. Those two little movements there I mean, they work brilliantly for Michael Vaughan, but if you get that wrong, you can end up with your front foot across your back foot, and then you're anything that's on the stumps, you're playing around your front pad. You can't get the bat to the ball. You could be bowled, you could be LBW, or you certainly can't on drive the ball. You have to hit it through square leg.
Yeah.
So the short answer is a trigger move will probably, in most cases, make things worse. So don't do it. Stand still. Unless you're up against a really, really quick bowler, which you don't tend to get at club level. There's no need to have one. The trick is to stand still, pick up the line and length of the ball as quickly as you can, select the correct shot for that line and length, and then execute the shot as effectively as possible. If you say that quickly, it sounds really easy, but that is the absolute core of batting, and that's what makes it so difficult and so much fun when you get it right. There's nothing more fun than picking up a half volley outside the off stump, knowing you're going to get there, and then smashing it through mid-off or through extra cover and thinking, there we go, perfect, that's exactly what I needed to do. And there's nothing more infuriating than when you get that wrong and you nick off. So I'm not saying stand like a statue. You don't want, you know, your knees straight and sort of everything all stiff and tensed up. You want to be relaxed. You want to be ready to move. You want to be really focused on the ball. But your body is a bit like, you know, like a coiled spring. All that energy stored up. You're ready to move backwards or forwards as soon as you picked up the line and length of the ball. Knees slightly bent. Be ready. Be on the balls of your feet. Be ready to move, but not actually moving. And then, as we always say, the key to picking up line and length early is to face as much bowling as you can. Because that's the only way you're going to... There's no shortcuts, as far as I know, anyway. I mean, if I ever find one, I'll put it in a bottle and sell it, because imagine how powerful that would be, as if you could say to someone, right, all you need to do is A, B and C, and then you'll be able to pick up the line and length as quickly as Kevin Peterson. Then, yeah. You know, how much money would people pay for that?
Yeah.
But unfortunately, there's no real shortcut to doing it. The more bowling you face of different speeds, different trajectories, the better you get at subconsciously picking up where the ball is going to go before it's even been bowled. You know, you can see just from the movements of the bowler or just slightly different release point of the bowler, you can pick up the length of the ball much more quickly.
Yeah.
So it's boring, but the best thing that can be done is to practice against bowlers until you learn to pick up line and length more quickly.
Yeah.
And that's it. You know,
sad advice.
I know we talk about it a lot on the show, and the reason we talk about it a lot on the show is because I am trying to find that secret method as well, because it's infuriating. You know, it's infuriating. But I think really there isn't a secret method. Don't face too many balls on the bowling machine where you can't pick up the bowler's clues. Face as much bowling. It doesn't matter what type of bowling it is. You know, if there's an under 13 who's just hanging around the nets, just get him to bowl to you. Because the more real bowlers that you face, the better you get at picking up line and length. And don't worry about trigger moves.
Well, David Ahad Khan has another batting question, and he says, I have really good timing, but my problem is that always hit the ball straight to where the fielder is. Everyone says that the ball goes really fast, but it's not useful because I don't get any runs. Can you help me? David, we've spoken about this on the show before. A possible solution could be visualizing in the nets, having cones, making a hard practice to hit between the cones and giving him targets to hit at. Would that be a possible solution? Or is there something deeper than that?
Definitely, that's a good way to approach it practice-wise. However, I don't think it's a practice thing at all. And the reason why I don't think that is because of the way he said it. He said, I always time it where the fielder is actually standing. Always. Yeah. Now, I'm going to lay down a challenge to Ahad and say, right, I'm going to put a fielder extra cover. I'm going to set up a bowling machine to bowl you a half volley just outside off stump. You have to hit it as if you're trying to hit a boundary, but you have to hit it to that fielder 10 times in a row. I would put down quite a lot of money that there is no way on earth he will hit that fielder 10 times in a row, even if he's trying. Even if he's trying his hardest. And he's not allowed to dink it to him. He's got to play a proper cover drive to it. Do you know anyone who could do that?
No. If I did, he'd be up there in the Australian cricket team.
Exactly. So I think it's a mental issue. I don't think he's always hitting the fielder. I think he's thinks he's always hitting the fielders. And it can be frustrating sometimes. We've all seen batsmen. Maybe we've all played innings where you've played some lovely shots and they've gone straight to the fielder.
Yeah.
And you think, oh, I'm hitting the fielder all the time here. What's going on? You look at the scoreboard, you're 20 not out. Well, you kind of hit the fielder every time. Look, you're 20 not out. So the answer I would say, which sounds a little bit glib, is stop worrying about it so much. As long as you're at the crease and as long as you're technically doing things correctly, and it sounds like you are, if you can time the ball well, then you must have a half-decent technique, then eventually, just by pure luck, you will hit the gap.
Yeah.
It might take a while. It might take... You might be at the crease for... I don't know how long games he plays, but let's assume he's playing an all-day game. You know, he might be at the crease for 40 minutes, an hour even, before he's able to regularly hit the gaps. But Alvin Kalacharan once told me, the longer you're at the crease, the smaller the fielders get and the bigger the gaps get. Because you just naturally, you get your eye in and suddenly those great big white blobs which are blocking your way, which seem like a wall in front of you, get very, very small when you're hitting the ball well.
Yeah.
So focus on getting your eye in, playing in a technically correct way, if you've got the time to do that. I'm assuming it's not 2020 cricket. Playing in a technically correct way, work on being able to play your shots as technically correct as you can, and just be confident that if you hit a cover drive, an on drive, an off drive, a cut, a pull, sweep, whatever the shot is, even if there is a fielder there, the chances are, if you hit it along the ground, then hard enough, then they're not going to be able to get to it most times.
Yeah.
And if by pure luck you do hit it to the fielder a couple of times in a row, don't get stressed about it and then try and smash one that isn't there. Just say to yourself, okay, missed out there, but I'll get the next one because statistically speaking, there's no way I can hit the same fielder 10 times in a row. So in the end, I'm going to hit it past him for a boundary. And then hitting the gaps will just come naturally. The longer you stay at the crease, the more naturally the gaps will come and the more quickly you'll score. And then even if you scoring slowly at the beginning, you can make up for it at the end. You know, if you have if you're still batting at the end and you can hit three or four boundaries in an over, then, you know, that makes up for the couple of maidens that you faced out because you kept hitting the fielders. But you can't score any runs, no matter how good your timing is, if you're in the pavilion. So don't get stressed about it. Just stay there until it comes, because eventually it will.
Yeah. David DM has a problem. He says he can't do clap push-ups, but he says he doesn't understand why. He says he's able to increase his sets and reps to 3 sets of 12 reps, but he still can't manage to do clap push-ups. I'm assuming he can do normal push-ups, David, but he just can't do clap push-ups. Do you know why, David?
The problem here is the difference between a clap push-up and a normal press-up or push-up. In that, you know, a normal push-up is essentially an exercise that tests your stomach muscles and your, to a lesser extent, your chest and arm muscles. You're pushing your weight against the floor. It's a traditional exercise. With a clap push-up, it's a power exercise, i.e. it's how quickly you can, your body can produce power while still keeping your abdominal and lower back muscles braced against folding in. So that's the difference. One's power, one is more to do with strength.
Yeah.
So there's a couple of reasons why you might be able to do one and not the other. The first one really is that you're trying to go from press-ups straight to clap push-ups, and not everybody can do that because they're slightly different types of exercises. So maybe start with something a little bit easier to do. The easiest type of clap push-up would be where you do it against the wall. So instead of doing it on the ground, you find a wall, you you stand a little bit away from it, you lean into the wall, and then you just push yourself off the wall.
Yeah.
That's quite easy. Most people should be able to do that, no problem. If you can do that, then you can progress to maybe getting a bench and pushing yourself off there. Because again, that's slightly easier. You don't have as far to go. And you don't have to fly up in the air massively high. You can just push yourself off the ground, leave the ground, not even enough to clap, but just leave the ground and then land again. You can do it that way. Mm. And then the stronger you get, the further you can push yourself off the ground in order to get that clap in. And the other thing you can do is, if you've got access to one of those old-fashioned medicine balls which are filled with sand, or whatever, the heavy ones that are filled with sand or whatever it is, then you could put your hands on that, on the medicine ball, and start in the up position for the push-up, push yourself off, land in the down position for the push-up with your hands apart, and then and then control your descent so your chest just touches the top of the medicine ball, then push yourself back up and land back on the medicine ball again. That's that's a little bit more of a difficult one, but if you, it's slightly easier than doing the clap push-ups. So that's another variation that you can attempt.
Yeah.
You can also try and increase your power output, your upper body power output in other ways. You know, you could try doing, you know, more traditional Olympic type lifts. You know, you could do the snatch, you could do the clean, you could do variations of those, you know, the high pull, the there's lots of different variations which are up on the Pitch Vision Academy website, which you can have a look at, where you don't need to learn the full Olympic lifts. That would help. You can try throwing a medicine ball. There's medicine ball chest passes. You can throw it against the wall and catch it. That would help.
Yeah.
Any exercise which increases your ability to produce force quickly is going to be helping with clap push-ups. Mm. And then the last thing is that maybe, I don't know anything about DM, I don't know how heavy he is, but maybe he needs to lose a little bit of weight.
Yeah.
Because it's a body weight resistance exercise, and if we were talking about a traditional resistant exercise, someone couldn't do that particular weight, what would you say? You'd say lower the weight, wouldn't you? So if you're talking about lowering the weight for a body weight exercise, you need to shed off some body fat if you're carrying a little bit too much. And you know, we've talked about ways to do that. There's a podcast, I'll put a link to it in the show notes, where we talk to Lee Peel, who is a fat loss expert, for want of a better word, and she can help you with diet and exercise in order to get your body weight down, and that may be enough to give you some clap push-ups.
All right, David, our world-renowned Pitch Vision competition. We have two batting questions and a fitness question. What's going to get it this week?
Well, I think Adam's question was quite interesting, so we'll give him the award for this week. So Adam, if you want to get back in touch with us, we'll give you your free Pitch Vision Academy coaching course.
Well done, Adam. And all he had to do was email in his question to micricketcoach@pitchvision.com, and he had to put into the title podcast competition. So that's all you have to do to be on your way to win a free course on Pitch Vision Academy. And you can also get more information, tips, advice, and tricks on our website at www.pitchvision.com. The site is updated daily and includes forums to chat with other cricketers around the world. You can also subscribe to the Pitch Vision Academy show for free on iTunes, or you can click the link on the show's page that will take you directly to iTunes to subscribe. Stay tuned for our next show on the 2nd of July. So if you want to get in touch with us, have any questions, or you want to enter the Pitch Vision competition, you can email us at micricketcoach@pitchvision.com. Thanks for your time, and we hope to see you next time. So from Sydney, Australia, this is Kevin Sampath signing off.
And this is David Hinchliffe in the UK.